Okay. There was something that I forgot to say last time, which is that when I was talking about time coordinates, I in the FRW spacetime, I said that proper time, conformal time, and scale factor were useful time coordinates, but you also see the redshift z, which is the same thing as the scale factor a up to a change of variables. The astronomers like to use z instead of a. That's a directly observable thing, either z or a, when you observe a galaxy. If we're at a equals 1 and we observe a distant galaxy on our past light cone at some scale factor a, then the spectral lines emitted by that galaxy will be redshifted as their frequencies will be shifted, redshifted as a to the minus 1 or equivalently 1 plus z. That's not something that is obvious from staring at the FRW metric, the existence of this redshift. We define the scale factor as a coefficient in the FRW metric, and it's not obvious that that's the same thing as the redshift that frequencies experience when they're emitted at an earlier time and received at a later time. It's something that you show by doing a big GR calculation. You have to calculate Christoffel symbols, integrate the geodesic equation, and see how the zero component of the photon photon's four momentum, or the photon's energy, changes. I'm just assuming that you did this in the first cosmology class, so I just want to write it down but not review it in detail. These things are in the lecture notes. I just forgot to say them in the lecture, but I want to make the lectures self-contained. Last time we started talking about random variables, in particular Gaussian random variables. The context is that the early universe is a very Gaussian place, as you can appreciate by analyzing CMB maps. If I take the Planck CMB map and just do something simple like histogram the temperatures over all pixels in the map, then I'll reproduce the Gaussian bell curve. This is temperature versus frequency of occurrence. As another example, if I take the temperature at two locations on the map, maybe I sample all pairs of pixels that have a fixed separation angle, say 60 degrees, then I'll get some scatter plot of temperature in one pixel versus temperature in the other pixel. Those variables will be jointly Gaussian distributed. The equal probability contours will be ellipses, as expected for a multivariate Gaussian. In fact, the standard model of cosmology predicts that the entire CMB map, all 10 to the 7 pixels in the CMB map, would be a giant multivariate Gaussian with 10 to the 7 components. That's something that I'll talk about in more detail. The universe starts out as a bunch of correlated Gaussian random variables. Any question that you want to ask, at least in the early universe, before nonlinear processes make things non-Gaussian, can be answered by some sort of calculation involving Gaussian random numbers. I mostly today want to talk about Gaussian random fields, but I think it's useful to start out by talking about Gaussian random variables, meaning that the random variable is an n-component vector rather than a function. So I here can go from 1 to n. The blackboard examples that I'll draw will tend to have n equals 2, two components like here, but you can think about the case of the CMB where n might be a huge number, like the number of pixels on a map. So some quantities that come up all the time are the mean, this is really just the definition. When I put a bar over something, it's the same thing as an expectation value. And the covariance matrix. Mean is a vector. The covariance is a matrix. And it's defined like this. In every statistics book, you'll see these two equivalent definitions. Just for fun, let's write out the proof that these two definitions of the covariance matrix are equal. So if I start with, let me start with this and try to get here. So first I'll factor this out. And I used in this step a property of the expectation value, which I had in slides last time. I want to put everything that was in the slides last time on the board today. So some properties of the expectation value are that these are easy to show if you use the definition of an expectation value as an integral over a PDF. That the expectation value of a sum or difference is the same thing as the sum or difference of the expectation values. Here, x and y are any two random variables. I can bring a constant outside the expectation value. So this is true if c is a constant, i.e. non-random. But I can't do it more generally with two random variables. This statement is only true if x and y are statistically independent. In fact, if it were true in general, then the covariance matrix would be zero, as you can see from this first definition. You could just factor this and make it zero. So the covariance matrix is sort of one way to think about it is that it's quantifying the extent to which this equality is failing for a pair of random variables. All right, so going back to this calculation, we'll leave this term alone. In this term, now xj bar, because the mean has been taken, this is just the constant with no randomness in it, so I can bring it out and write this as xi bar xj bar. Same thing in this term. And in this term, there's no randomness at all. This is just the expectation value of a constant. So the expectation value is superfluous, and I can say that's equal to xi bar xj bar. And then canceling terms, this is equal to xi xj minus xi bar xj. So this subject is full of little, three-line calculations like this. And sometimes in the lecture, I'll work them out, like here, if I want to use them as an excuse to talk about something. Like here, I really just wanted to use this three-line calculation as an excuse to write down these properties. And I'll often just skip over and say, by a three-line calculation, you can show that this is true. But history has shown that when I give lectures, sometimes I forget to say anything at all, and I'll use some property like this without mentioning it. So, which is bad. So if there's a calculational gap in anything that I'm doing, please speak up so that I can just at least, say what property I'm implicitly using. All right. So interpret the meaning of the covariance matrix is that oh, I forgot that was broken. The meaning of the covariance matrix is that the diagonal of the matrix gives you the variances of the components of the random variable x. And variances quantify the level of fluctuation around the mean, or rather the square root of the variance is the typical size of fluctuations around the mean. The diagonals of the covariance matrix are telling you how two components of the vector correlate. And it's often the correlation coefficient is defined to be correlation coefficient between two random variables is just defined to be the covariance with the variances scaled out, or can take an off-diagonal element of the covariance matrix and divide by the square root of the product of the two corresponding diagonal elements. And this is always between minus 1 and 1. And it's well, I'll show this later. So this correlation coefficient is quantifying what you mean when you say that two variables are negatively or positively correlated. The following cartoon might help to get a sense for what the covariance matrix means if I had a two by two covariance matrix. Then and let's say the PDF were Gaussian, so that the error regions are ellipses. Then the ellipse is centered at the mean, of course. And the diagonal elements would be correspond to this distance, or rather their square roots would tell you the characteristic size of fluctuations around the mean. Let me draw an example where the variances are different. Let's say this one is larger than this one. Now imagine that I leave the diagonal fixed and vary this off-diagonal element between its minimum amount, its minimum allowed value, which is minus square root C11, C22, and its maximum allowed value, which is the square root of C11, C22. That's the statement that this correlation coefficient is between minus 1 and 1. Then the way that the error ellipse would change in this example was it would always sort of stay within a bounding box defined by the diagonals. But you would see it go from, this would be maybe correlation 0.5. And the correlation, the case where the correlation coefficient is minus 1, would be an infinitely thin ellipse. The case where the correlation is 0 would be an ellipse whose principal axes are this diagram is getting a little crowded, but that's OK. The case where the off-diagonal element is 0 would be the case of an ellipse whose principal axes are lined up with the coordinate axes. All right. Now I want to work out the transformation law for the mean and covariance of a random variable when a linear transformation is applied. So let xi be a random variable. And define a new random variable y by multiplying by some matrix. Oh, yes? Yes,
yes. So that plot that you have there, we would get it if we have two random variables, x1 and x2, with a Gaussian probability distribution, both of them.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, for a non-Gaussian, when I draw ellipses, I'm assuming that the probability that the random variable is Gaussian, so that the level contours are ellipses. Otherwise, the covariance is only not capturing the full PDF, it's only capturing the first and second moments. And you could have some complicated number.
And so I will get this ellipse if I'm drawing, and every time I'm drawing like X1 and X2 with that PDF.
That's right.
And I'm plotting it in like an X1, X2 plot.
That's right.
But the contour of the ellipse, is that the one sigma deviation?
Yeah, I guess I was in my head. I was drawing the one sigma contours.
Okay.
There would also be ellipses if you plotted the two sigma contours. Where,
but
if you...
the square root of C22, that is one sigma.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. Okay. So consider this setup. I have some random variable, an n component vector, and I define a new random variable by multiplying it by a matrix. The matrix here doesn't need to be a square matrix. It could be an m by n rectangular matrix so that y has m components. That's why I use different letters, a for an index that goes from 1 to m, and I for an index that runs from 1 to n. Sorry, this should be an a. A is a matrix. All right. Then let's work out how the mean... the mean and covariance of y are related to those of x. So by a little three-line calculation that I won't write out, it's easy to show that the expectation value of y is just a times the mean of y is the matrix times the mean of x, as you would expect. And the transformation law for the covariance matrix is the following. Or in matrix notation, y bar is a times x bar, and cy is A times CX times A transpose. So it's useful to think of the mean and covariance as geometric objects, as geometric vectors and matrices that you can transform around. You can change coordinate system, for example. The covariance matrix here is transforming under linear transformations the same way that the metric transforms in GR, for example. All right. So far, everything is that I've said applies to any random variable. I want to talk about Gaussian random variables. So a random variable is xi is Gaussian. If its probability distribution function is this form, for some choice of mean x bar, and covariance matrix Cij. Notice that's the inverse. First off, one thing that's true is that if I calculate the mean and covariance of this distribution from their definitions, then I do get xi bar and Cij as the notation suggests. Notice that it's the inverse covariance matrix that appears inside the X, and this determinant is just the coefficient that you need to make the integral of the PDF come out to 1. The best way to derive this would be to prove the central limit theorem. In the course of that proof, this formula would naturally emerge, which shows that if I just add up a bunch of uncorrelated and or independent and identically distributed random variables, then the result Gaussianizes. The property of the Gaussian PDF, one property that's really important is that the mean for a Gaussian random variable the mean and covariance determine the entire distribution. Of course, that's not true in general. In general, the PDF is just some free function of n variables. The only constraints are it has to be positive everywhere, and its integral has to be 1. And there are way more degrees of freedom in that than in one vector and one matrix, which are giving you the 1 and 2 point moments of the distribution. Now, a very useful fact that about Gaussian random variables that we're going to end up, let's say that's property 1, property 2, that we're going to end up using all the time is that linear combinations of Gaussians are Gaussian. Let's write it this way. If Xi is Gaussian, then Y equals AX, where A is any matrix, is also Gaussian. I'll omit the proof. It is another three-line calculation. If you change variables in this PDF, if you start with something which is x, but something quadratic in x, and then you make a linear change of variables, you'll get x of something quadratic in y. That's how the proof works. So in particular, and the matrix A here doesn't need to be a square matrix. It could be rectangular if there are fewer components in y than x. Earlier, I had made this statement that if you histogram pixels in the C and B map, you get a Gaussian distribution. The reason that's true is that if I start with a multivariate Gaussian in 10 to the 7 variables, and then I just keep one pixel in the map and throw the other pixel values away, that's a special case where the matrix here is 1 by n. I'm just picking out one pixel, one component of an n component vector, and all the components of that 1 by n matrix, all the entries are 0 except for 1. So the operation of just selecting a pixel in a map and throwing out the other pixels is a linear operation that goes from a PDF in, takes a Gaussian PDF in many variables and gives you a one variable Gaussian. All right. So a lot of problems involving random variables are really linear algebra problems in disguise. And the challenge is figuring out how to transport your linear algebra toolkit and intuition over into the statistical context. So as an example, I want to think about this question. Let's think about the problem of simulating a multivariate Gaussian. To state the problem precisely, suppose that someone gives you like a 10 by 10 covariance matrix, C. And you want to write a computer program to draw a random sample xi from the Gaussian distribution with the given covariance matrix, the multivariate Gaussian. Let's say the mean is 0, just for simplicity. And suppose that you have in your toolkit a standard linear algebra package. You can invert matrices, for example. And that the case n equals 1 has already been solved. So you have some function you can call that will draw a sample from a one variable PDF. That's actually not completely trivial to write, but I want to skip over that part. So how would you, given the ability to draw a random sample from a one variable PDF, how would you draw a random sample from an n variable PDF with some correlations, with some non-zero off-diagonal entries in the covariance. Actually, this will be a linear algebra problem. Actually, let's just start with the case n equals 2, which I had drawn before, where I have some, so I have some 2 by 2 covariance matrix. And my geometric picture is that I have some rotated ellipse. Are there any suggestions for what to do? Oh, yeah, yeah. So I was going to like bootstrap through some examples, but you went right to the general n case. That's right. So in n equals 2, you know, what I would want to do is rotate coordinates so that the axes of the ellipse are lined up. And that's the case where the two components are independent. So I can just draw a random variable, a Gaussian random variable in the first component, a Gaussian random variable for the second component. And then I rotate those back to the original coordinate system. So this process of rotating the ellipse is a way of thinking about, in two dimensions, diagonalizing a matrix. And in n dimensions, diagonalization, you know, is a process that could take an arbitrarily oriented ellipse and line up its principal axes with the axes of your n-dimensional coordinate system. So to just to write out the math, that was kind of a word argument. Just to write out the math, there's a theorem in linear algebra that says that given any symmetric matrix C, there's a rotation matrix that makes C look like this, where R is a rotation. And delta is a diagonal matrix. And then if X, if I draw a random variable X with covariance delta, given a diagonal covariance matrix, I can simulate the corresponding Gaussian random variable by just simulating the elements of the vector independently with the appropriate variant. Then R times X has covariance. By our general rule, R delta R transpose. And for a rotation matrix is defined by the condition that its inverse is equal to its transpose. So that is the same thing as R delta R inverse, or C, which proves that, let's call this Y. Y equals Rx has the covariance that we wanted. Just for fun, so diagonalization is a linear algebra tool that solves this problem. Just for fun, can anyone think of another way to do it without diagonalizing? It's not the only, there are other linear algebra tricks that work to solve this problem. Like another thing that would work is to Cholesky decompose the matrix. There's a, in linear algebra, any symmetric positive definite matrix has a Cholesky factorization, where L was lower triangular. And then if X has covariance equal to the identity matrix, then LX has covariance. By our general rule, LI, L transpose, which is C. Linear algebra is a powerful toolkit, and there's lots of tricks that from linear algebra that you can use to solve problems in statistics. Diagonalization is way more intuitive in this example, but the Cholesky factorization is a little faster on the computer, so this is what the libraries will use. All right, one more statistics problem, which is really a linear algebra problem in disguise. It's a theorem that for any random variable, the covariance matrix is, so it's one thing that's true is that it's manifestly symmetric, a symmetric matrix. And another thing that's true is that it's positive semi-definite. Meaning that all eigenvalues are non-negative. Positive definite means that the eigenvalues are strictly positive. Positive semi-definite means greater than or equal to zero. So can anyone give an argument why this is true? Well, how about the case n equals 1, where the covariance matrix is just a 1-by-1 matrix containing a variance? Not totally obvious if you've never thought about it before, but this formula for the variance, this expression, is the expectation value of a square, which is always, since the square is always positive, when I average it over some probability distribution, I also get a number which is greater than or equal to zero. So that's the 1-by-1 case. How about the case of general n? So this is another case where diagonalization is sufficient. If I started with an arbitrary matrix and I rotated to some new coordinate basis, I would have a random variable whose covariance matrix is diagonal, where the entries on the diagonal are the eigenvalues of the original matrix. And then it follows from the n equals 1 case that these are all variances, so they all have to be greater than or equal to zero. This proves, so this is a constraint on that a matrix needs to satisfy in order to be a covariance matrix. This proves, by the way, a property that we stated earlier, that the correlation coefficient is always between -1 and 1. In the 2-by-2 case, this is the condition that the determinant of the matrix be greater than or equal to zero. If you write that out, you'll see that it's equivalent to the correlation coefficient. A little few line calculation shows it's equivalent to the condition that C11 squared be less than or equal to C12 squared be less than or equal to C11 C22, which means that this quantity is between -1 and 1. In the n-by-n case, it's a theorem from linear algebra that if I have any positive definite matrix, and then I take any 2-by-2 submatrix, or indeed a submatrix of any size, the determinant of that so-called minor matrix is always positive. So for any pair xi, xj, the associated determinant is always positive, and the associated correlation coefficient is between -1 and 1. So a lot of the theorems in statistics textbooks are really just linear algebra statements in disguise. All right, now I want to talk about random fields. So random fields are sort of a step up in abstraction, where instead of thinking about a random variable, which is a vector of n components, I want to take a continuum limit so that I get a random field. And this is almost more of a difference in notation than a substantial difference. If I have a 1D random field would be some function x of t. Like a random walk would be an example of a random field in one dimension, where I just a Gaussian random walk would mean that as I go along, I progress the random walk by simulating Gaussian random numbers and adding them to the previous value. If I make this random walk finite in extent, and I also discretely sample it, then I have a random variable xi. And of course, that's always what happens on the computer. And then to go the other way, I just imagine taking the continuum limit where the spacing goes to zero and the length of the interval goes to infinity. So there's not really much difference between the two cases. It's largely a matter of notation. So in one dimension, I'll start out talking about random fields in 1D. And I'll use t for the coordinate because I like to think about it being time. So the random vector xi is now a function, random function. X of t. The mean xi bar in general would become a function. X bar of t. The covariance matrix, Cij. So if there are no symmetry assumptions on their random 1D field, no assumption of time translation symmetry, then this would just become a function of two variables. A two-point function would just be a free function of two variables. I don't think there's a standard letter to use, but let me call it C by analogy with the vector case. In the absence of any symmetry assumption, let's write it as minus x. This function of two variables would be the generalization of the covariance matrix. In the vector case, the covariance matrix had two free indices, and here there are two free parameters. Now, let's say if no symmetry is assumed. Now, when we talk about random fields, we're almost always interested in the case where some symmetries are assumed to exist. So if time translation symmetry is assumed, if I write here, can you guys see it, or is the podium in the way? Let me just raise the board. On the other hand, if time translation is assumed, then the two-point function, the covariance, rather than being a free function of two variables t and t prime, could only depend on their difference. You might imagine a covariance matrix, if this were discretely sampled, then the covariance matrix would have the property that the diagonal elements are all the same, the elements that are one above the diagonal are all the same, and so on. And this function zeta is called the correlation function. Although, for a statistician, covariance function would probably be the better name. So we'll always be interested. We'll always be interested in the case where the mean is zero. And where time translation symmetry is understood to apply. So let's write that as that condition. All the random fields that we'll be interested in cosmology will turn out to have these properties. I wanted to start out with a more general definition, but I'll assume this from now on, just to make things a little make the calculations a little simpler. By the way, in the context of a random field, time translation symmetry, of course, it means that the statistics are time translation invariant. If I were to take the example of a random walk, I have some random walk x of t, and I translate it in time, then the statement is that the original random walk and the time-translated random walk are equally probable to occur. Of course, the particular realization of the random variable will not be time-translation invariant. These are different random walks. So we'll often want to think about random fields in Fourier space. So my conventions for the Fourier transform are as follows. Sorry, plus here, minus here. With plus here, minus here, and the 2π here. Now, we'll be interested in the next thing I want to do is for a random field with a given correlation function, I want to calculate this expectation value, which is the, let me call that the Fourier space two-point function. And before I calculate it, I want to anticipate the constraints that will arise from time translation symmetry. For the time domain two-point function, it was intuitively obvious that the time translation symmetry amounted to the statement that this two-point function just depends on the separation between the times. Just for fun, does anyone know offhand what the corresponding statement is here? If I have a random field and the only assumption is time translation invariance, then this expectation value will be constrained by symmetry. Does anyone know what the constraint is? So it turns out, I'll prove this in a minute, that so if no time translation symmetry were assumed, then this would just be a free function of omega and omega prime. But in the presence of time translation symmetry, you always get a delta function on the right-hand side. The coefficient of the delta function can be a free function of one variable omega. And this equation defines the power spectrum B. This is really it's both a theorem and a definition. The content of the theorem is the delta function always has to appear, and its coefficient is defined to be the power spectrum. So the reason that symmetry requires the existence of that delta function is as follows. First off, Maybe someone can tell me what time translation looks like in the Fourier domain. In other words, if I have a one-dimensional function and I shift it in the time domain, let's write that like this. Define a new function by time translating some function x, then how would the Fourier coefficients of x and x prime be related? That's right. With my Fourier conventions, the phase turns out to have a minus in it. And this is an easy calculation. So now let's look at that's what happens at the level of the Fourier modes of the field when I apply the time translation symmetry. Let's see what happens to this two-point correlation. So if I took a... got carried away. So I'm interested in this two-point correlation function. If I shift time translate the field and compute the same correlation function, then this guy gets a phase e to the minus I omega delta t, and this guy gets a phase e to the plus I omega prime delta t. So this is one equation I can write. And another thing that must be true is that this expectation value is equal to the same expectation value for x without the phase. Because I'm assuming time translation invariance, so I should get the same expectation value whether I compute it for x prime or x. Those fields are supposed to have the same, those time translated versions of the same field are supposed to have the same statistic. So now I've reached what kind of looks like a contradiction. I have this equal to itself with this phase in front that's not equal to 1. And the only way that's not a contradiction, the only way out, is that if there's a delta function here, this function of omega and omega prime, has a delta function in it, which forces the phase to be 1 whenever the expectation value is non-zero. So that's why under time translations, you know, this guy would shift by e to the I omega t, this guy would shift by e to the minus I omega t, and that's only consistent. You can only correlate if omega is equal to omega prime. So I'm going to calculate this expectation value. I just wanted to point out before calculating it that there's a constraint that we can anticipate from symmetry. Let's do the calculation. I'll calculate that Fourier space two-point function, assuming that x is a random field with correlation function zeta. And this is a calculation that I want to do in detail because there are some fine points that come up. So here's what I'm trying to compute. In the first step, I'll write out the definition of x tilde. plus I omega t. Omega prime t prime. In this next step, I'm not doing anything. I'm just shuffling around. All right. So in this step, I want to pull the integrals outside of the expectation value and this phase. So why is this valid? Why am I allowed to do this? Well, it sort of follows from some blackboard somewhere. I have properties of the expectation value. Maybe, I think I maybe erased it. But there are these properties of the expectation value that you know it commutes with taking sums, and it commutes with multiplying by a constant. And the integral is just a sum in disguise. The integral is just a imagine you just had a single integral and no phase. You know, I can think of that as summing up a bunch of small numbers with a delta t. And both sums and multiplying by constants commute with taking expectation values, go through the expectation value. And so because an integral is just really, in disguise, a sum plus some multiplications by constants, I can bring the expectation value through both integrals and also through this phase, which is a non-random constant. So this step is this step in the calculation is pretty intuitive and easy to just do without really thinking about it. I just wanted to point out why it was true. All right. Next step. I'll write this as zeta. Then, to start doing these integrals, first I'm going to change variables to change variables from t prime to t double prime, which is defined to be t minus t prime, and then make that change a variable in the inner integral. So this becomes e to the minus I omega t plus I omega prime t minus t double prime, zeta t double prime. After the step, it's just sort of following your nose and turning the crank. I can do the t double prime integral to this is e to the minus I minus omega prime times t. And then if I do the t double prime integral, I'm just integrating zeta of t double prime times the phase e to the minus I omega prime t double prime, which is the same thing as the Fourier transform of zeta evaluated at omega prime. And then that last integral just gives the delta function. When I do the t integral, I just get a delta function in omega minus omega prime. And that was what I expected to get by symmetry. So this calculation is a check that we should get this delta function. We get this delta function, making no assumptions other than the time translation invariance that let me go from here to here. And it also proves something, namely that the power spectrum, which was defined to be the coefficient of the delta function here, is equal to the Fourier transform of the correlation function. So this statement that the power spectrum and the correlation function are Fourier transforms of each other is called the Wiener-Kinchin theorem. It shows that the correlation function and the power spectrum contain the same information and just describe the two-point structure of the random field either in position space or in Fourier space. I defined a random field via its correlation function, but you could also define it via the power spectrum. Okay. So calculations involving random fields are really ubiquitous in cosmology. So I want to talk about some examples. Here's a question. I'll give it its own blackboard. If X is a random field with some power spectrum P sub X, I define a new random field Y by differentiating T, then what is the power spectrum of Y? How is it related to power spectrum of X? Sorry. That is, you have the right idea, but it should be omega squared. That's because the power spectrum is an expectation value of the square. So at the level of the, you can think at the level of the modes of the field first. At the level of the field, differentiation just multiplies by I omega. Fourier transform converts this differential operator to an algebraic operator, which multiplies by I omega. And then because the power spectrum, you know, is defined as the this is the definition of PY. Because the power spectrum is defined as an expectation value of the product of two y's, when I put in two factors of I omega, then I get, well, the I here goes away because I have one I and one minus I. Then I get omega squared, yeah. So differentiation gives omega at the level of the modes and omega squared in the power spectrum. Here's another example. I have like four or five examples to share to try to just build up intuition for how these calculations work. One really simple type of random field is white noise. White noise is a random field is white noise if its correlation function is just a delta function in time. So what that would mean is that it's like the simplest possible random field where at every time I just randomly generate a random number the random number at t prime is uncorrelated, independent of the random number at time t. So like thermal fluctuations, if I have some sort of detector, like a CMB detector, it's measuring the CMB with some noise, the noise might be modelable this way if it's just some random thermal fluctuations that don't correlate from one time to the next. So one thing that comes up is, so this would be in the time domain, the correlation function of white noise is a delta function. The coefficient eta just gives the amplitude of the noise. Oh wow, I'm out of time. So I wanted to work out its power spectrum. And that could be done by this theorem that says that the power spectrum and the correlation function are Fourier transform. So if this is a delta function, then the integral just gives eta. So the power spectrum of white noise is constant. If I take the Fourier transform of white noise, then I would find that the power spectrum is telling you in the time domain the size of the variance of the Fourier transform. So the fact that that's constant in omega means that if I Fourier transform white noise, then I get a bunch of Fourier moments whose typical size is independent of omega. There's no tendency for the Fourier coefficients to be larger at small omega or larger at large omega. Okay, so I ran out of time. So tomorrow we'll start with more examples of random fields and calculations involving them.